Hello, 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 and welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with the world of finance, business, and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm your host, Max Tillman, and coming up on the program, how much tax does your super fund pay, and how do we even find out?
It begs the question, then, are the funds effectively managing tax? There are some funds that are thinking about tax quite actively.
Products. A lot more could go the way of... But first, have you ever considered how your financial investments line up with your morals? Many Rio Tinto shareholders have been following the destruction of the Juukan Gorge, sacred to the indigenous Putukunti Kurama and Pinikura people of the Pilbara region in Western Australia. While the Rio Tinto CEO Jean-Sébastien Jacques may have resigned, is it enough to change people and companies thinking about dollars more than cents? Sophia Turek has the story.
After months of anger from shareholders and Aboriginal groups, three Rio Tinto executives, including the CEO, Jean-Sébastien Jacques, resigned over the destruction of the Juukan Gorge rock shelter in the Pilbara in May. Rio Tinto's chairman, Simon Thompson, says it was shareholder pressure that ultimately led to the resignation of the CEO. Bryn O'Brien is the executive director of the Australasian Centre for Corporate Responsibility and says that shareholder activism can be powerful in holding companies accountable for their actions and lobbying for change.
Well, it depends on what kind of change you're seeking to achieve and how hard shareholders are willing to push and the size of the shareholders that are willing to push. So we just saw the CEO of Rio Tinto with two other senior executives exit, again, due to shareholder pressure. So the exit of really senior people, CEOs, senior executives, due to shareholder concerns, I mean, that is pretty powerful. I think with these investors realise that the challenges are systemic in the companies, that Rio Tinto has a problem with its relationships with First Nations communities and the lack of real authority that Aboriginal communities have in relation to protecting their cultural heritage under the West Australian law. So shareholders can be quite powerful. That's not to say they always are.
But more still needs to be done to ensure that companies follow through with their social and environmental responsibilities.
Shareholders need to now keep the pressure on to make sure that the replacements for those people are much better on First Nations cultural heritage issues. They really value Aboriginal cultural heritage and make it a priority within the company to preserve and protect. I think that the board will also come under scrutiny. So, I think shareholder power has so far gotten us to a certain point with Rio Tinto, but there is clearly far more that needs to be done.
I'm Roderick Chambers, and this week we also have a new story. There is growing debate over whether the government should go ahead with increasing the percentage of compulsory superannuation in light of the ongoing COVID-induced recession. On the one hand, our superannuation funders and former Prime Ministers Keating, Rudd and Turnbull argue that the legislated increase is a part of a long-term structural reform that would substantially benefit Australians when they retire. On the other are business groups, the Australian Council of Social Services, government backbenchers and the Reserve Bank, who argue that lifting the contributions employers must make would come at the expense of wages growth. Brendan Coates, Household Finances Program Director with the Grattan Institute, has examined the relationship between wages growth and superannuation contributions. He spoke with Toby Hemmings earlier this afternoon.
initially something reserved for white-collar and middle-class professionals. Over time, it became normalised into bargaining agreements, and by 1992, Paul Keating's government had legislated that all employers must make a contribution into their employees' superannuation fund. The amount employers must contribute rose to 9% and was set to resume progressively increasing by 0.5% next year until COVID-19 hit.
The underlying work was that quite sensibly that superannuation would complement individuals' retirement incomes, and that's what it's done. So it's certainly led to higher retirement incomes than would otherwise be the case.
Brendan Coates is the Household Finances Program Director with the Grattan Institute.
I think the question that remains today is kind of like, what precisely is the right level that best balances people's opportunities to have an income and consume during their working life versus have an income and consume during retirement?
Brendan's work with the Grattan Institute has focused on whether superannuation contribution increases have come at a cost to wage growth for employees.
While the employer might pay, sign the cheque, it's the employee that tends to end up wearing the cost in the long run. Your employer has not been willing to offer sustained increases in wages above the rate of inflation in the last 5 years. So what about super means you think they're going to offer you more super and offer you higher remuneration? So not change your wages growth and still offer you that higher super out of their own pockets. Like, there's no mechanism here that suggests why that's going to happen when, you know, the evidence for the last 25 years is that it hasn't happened in the past.
Proponents such as former Prime Ministers Paul Keating and Kevin Rudd, as well as union leaders like Michelle O'Neill of the ACTU, have argued that the scrapping of the legislated increase in the super contribution won't necessarily lead to wage growth. Maybe so, says Brendan Coates, but that is because there are a lot of factors that underpin wage growth.
That's missing the fact that wages are driven by a whole bunch of different factors, and those factors have trended towards lower wage growth in recent years. You know, productivity growth has been weaker. The economy's arguably not been running at full potential.
Forecasts predict that the COVID-19 recession will be a deep and protracted one, with the Treasury forecasting unemployment remaining at 6% or above until 2025. As a result, there is an argument that increasing super contribution goes against what is needed to stimulate the economy.
Now, if you're in a recession, what you want to do is put money into workers' pockets to get them to spend, into the pockets of households and, you know, to a degree to encourage businesses to spend as well. Now, compulsory super, raising the rate in the middle of recession, does go in the opposite direction to that. Because if, you know, the mantra was go hard, go early, go households during the GFC, and we've done the same thing today with JobKeeper and the rise in JobSeeker, how would increase in the rate of compulsory super when the national savings rate, you know, hit 20%, household savings rate hit 20% in the June quarter, how is that consistent with a rapid recovery? It probably slows the pace of recovery.
Superannuation as an industry has approximately $3 trillion worth of assets and is factored to play a critical role in investing to help bring the economy out of this recession. Industry chiefs have voiced concern about policy uncertainty regarding the super guarantee, but Brendan Coates notes that the proposed increase is only a drop in the pond for these funds.
You know, the difference between 9.5% and 12% super does not matter very much to the pool of assets that super funds have available to them over the course of the next 5 years, because we are only talking about, you know, by 2025, an extra $20 billion a year of contributions in a system that has $3 trillion of assets. So all up, you know, compulsory super being 9.5% or 12% is probably, you know, a difference in the total asset base of superannuation funds by 2025 of maybe.
So what will end up happening with the proposed superannuation increase? The next federal budget is due to be handed down on October 6th, and Brendan Coates believes that the government has four options on the table.
They could allow it to go ahead, which, you know, may in fact be what the government decides to do. They could defer the increase for a period until we're out of the recession. They could cancel the increase outright. And the fourth option would be to allow people to cash out anything above the 9.5% rate. Given it does probably come from wages growth, the increase probably isn't a good idea because Australians are already saving enough to have a good living standard in retirement as what they have beforehand. And so therefore you shouldn't force them to save for a higher living standard in retirement while making them poorer beforehand, which is what increasing the SG would do, and therefore the SG rate should stay at something like 9.5%.
Brendan Coates, Household Finances Program Director with the Grattan Institute, ending that report by Toby Hemmings. I'm Roderick Chambers and you're listening to On The Money throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network. The last time Australia experienced a recession was in 1990, when Paul Keating was Treasurer and Labor was in power. One of the most pervasive arguments in Australian politics is that the ALP seem to be poor financial managers. But is that perception justified? Tina Quinn has this report.
After months of speculation over the effect that the coronavirus pandemic would have on the Australian economy, the federal government announced earlier this month that Australia was officially in a recession, with a record 7% contraction in the economy during the June quarter. This comes after 7 years of 0% economic growth and increasing national debt under the economic management of successive Liberal Party governments. Prior to the pandemic, our current Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, laid repeated claim to this being the fault of the opposition, the Australian Labor Party. And indeed, the ALP have long struggled with the perception that they are poor economic managers. But is this fact or simply mythology? To delve deeper into how Labor acquired this reputation and whether or not it was earned, I spoke with the former host of the ABC's Four Corners and the 7:30 Report, Kerry O'Brien.
The truth is that Labor's reputation as bad financial managers goes back to the Whitlam years. Labor had been in opposition for 23 years, from Menzies in 1949 through to when Whitlam defeated Billy McMahon to become Prime Minister in December of 1972. And the inexperience of sitting on opposition benches for 23 years showed in their economic management when they were hit by two oil shocks and a global recession in 74-75, compounded by a number of other scandals that dogged that government. From that point on, respective Liberal governments took great delight in playing up Labor as the party that couldn't manage the economy.
Following the historic dismissal of Prime Minister Gough Whitlam in 1975 came 8 years of a Conservative government and economic malaise under the leadership of Malcolm Fraser before Bob Hawke's landslide victory in the 1983 election. Australia had a new Prime Minister and a new Treasurer in Paul Keating. But as Hawke and Keating were soon to discover, the sizeable budget deficit left by the Fraser government's Treasurer John Howard would soon prove more challenging than originally anticipated.
When Labor came to power with Hawke as Prime Minister in 1983, Australia was just starting to come out of a recession when they discovered that the deficit was bigger than they'd been led to expect.
Laura Tingle, the 7:30 Report's chief political correspondent, spent the early part of her career in the 1980s covering the powerful Hawke and Keating partnership and their deregulation of Australia's finance industry. I spoke with Laura about this transformative and ultimately defining period in Australia.
Global view of economics had changed between the time Labor was in office under Gough Whitlam and Bob Hawke won in 1983. Malcolm Fraser himself had been fairly grudging in moving towards deregulation, whereas his Treasurer John Howard was much keener. Monetarism was all the rage. Deregulation and free markets were sweeping the world with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. So there was a sort of an immense pressure on all governments to get with the program, if you like.
Kerry O'Brien recalls how the reforms of this period brought about the return of universal healthcare to Australia, a previous initiative by Gough Whitlam, but then limited to paying customers only by the Fraser government.
And the whole Australian economy was shifting across from that kind of traditional blue-collar manufacturing base to the service sector. And part of the trade-off with the unions was the introduction of social programs like Medicare, and later on, the compulsory superannuation scheme.
Laura Tingle again.
There was immense pressure on the foreign exchange markets, which at that stage were still completely regulated. The government had to devalue the currency and then look at revaluing it. That triggered a whole range of decisions. It meant that there were immediately immense pressures to deregulate the economy internally as well.
The reforms of the Hawke-Keating government during this period brought about much economic and social change that would go on to both define their legacy and prove to be the turning point in Australia's future prosperity.
Bob Hawke and Paul Keating were just the ultimate pragmatists. They wanted to make Labor the natural power of government. It was an expression that was used a lot to be regarded as good economic managers. And I think all of those things fed into the way they approached the task at hand.
Kerry O'Brien recalls an extremely competitive banking sector.
There was a much greater competition within the banking system, which had its own fallout and which was one of the factors which led to a huge boom in the economy, really. There was a big share market boom and there was so much money floating around.
The government's popularity at this time seemed unprecedented, and it showed when Hawke led Labor to victory in 1984 and again in 1987. But trouble was on the horizon.
First of all, there was the share market bust in October 1987, which sent shivers down the collective national spine in Australia.
The global stock market crash in October of 1987, known as Black Tuesday in Australia and Black Monday in the Northern Hemisphere markets, saw the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumble by a record 23%. The Australian market had seen heavy selling in the days leading up to it, but Black Tuesday's 25% slump was unprecedented. Brokers on the floor that day were flooded with calls from desperate sellers, but had no one on the other end of the line who wanted to buy.
But then it just resumed again, and the economy was overheated, and that led to the recession of 1990.
Australia at first seemed safeguarded from the massive repercussions that had hit globally, even budgeting an, at that time, record-breaking $9.1 billion surplus in 1989. But then the Reserve Bank of Australia began tightening monetary policy, and household interest rates peaked at 18%, and by 1990, the economy contracted by 1.6%. Kerry O'Brien recalls this period.
It was a recession that was caused by a booming economy, and as part of that boom, interest rates had gone up to unsustainable levels, and that was why businesses started to fail.
Laura Tingle again.
We didn't really know how to drive a deregulated economy. We'd gone from a period where the government could control wages, interest rates, as well as the budget, and suddenly it couldn't do all of those things that it previously could. And as it deregulated and changed the way the financial markets worked, there was a lot of static around about what sort of impact any change in monetary policy from the government was having. And it wasn't clear that the actual mechanisms being used on monetary policy were very effective. That meant that when you got what was a repeat experience, and has continued to be a repeat experience in Australia of resource booms and busts, the economy started to heat up. The government overdid it on interest rates for too long, and that caused the recession.
The economic fallout of the 87 crash and the subsequent Australian recession of 1990 was made worse by rising tensions between Bob Hawke and his right-hand man Paul Keating, which led to the latter's subsequent resignation and failed leadership challenge in 1991.
One of the factors that became crucial in Hawke-Keating leadership challenge was that they were sort of stuck on the mantra that you had to cut government spending, you had to have small government, you had to contract things out, sort of the same conversation that we've been having for the last 10 or 20 years.
After a second leadership challenge in December of that year, Keating was successful and Australia had a new PM. But Keating would have his work cut out for him in fixing a very wounded local economy. Kerry O'Brien again.
Even though that recession was quite a tough recession, the underpinning restructuring of the economy that had taken place in those Labor years guaranteed that when they came out of the recession, that when Australia came out of the recession, it would be in exceptional shape. It was those reforms of the 80s leading into the 90s in financial markets, in product markets, and then the beginnings of labour market reform that essentially guaranteed that Australia would stay in growth for nearly 30 years.
He was one of the first prime ministers who tried to do a big infrastructure spend to get us out of recession. But it just takes ages to get infrastructure going. And that's why, you know, it didn't really work for a number of years. And the economy was actually quite sluggish till the mid-1990s.
Keating's prime ministership was marked by a treasury that changed hands three times, from Ralph Willis to John Dawkins and then back to Ralph Willis again. Perhaps Keating's biggest failing lay more with his people management style than his economic one.
Ralph Willis was sort of in the job when Keating took over, but was moved aside for John Dawkins. As treasurer, I think, to Paul Keating, John Dawkins legacy, if you like, was that he was the one who had to try to make promises that were actually not financially possible by Paul Keating in the 93 election work. And he didn't, and he essentially recognised that that the tax cuts had been promised wouldn't be able to be financed, and that sort of left politics shortly afterwards. I think basically prepared to take the fall for that, but I suspect a little bit bitter about it nonetheless.
Laura Tingle, Chief Legal Correspondent with the ABC 7:30 report, ending that report from Tina Quinn. And tune in next week for part two of this series. This is On the Money, broadcast around Australia from the studios of 2SER FM on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers.
On the Money, get your shake of the sauce bottle.
On Monday, the Morrison government plans to go ahead with the $300 cut to the historic wages JobKeeper and JobSeeker subsidy. Subsidy was put in place to cushion the blow of the anticipated economic downturn. Despite large unemployment rates and an extended lockdown in Melbourne, the cut to push those entirely dependent on the subsidy to below the poverty line. Coronavirus-induced recession has highlighted the need for the welfare system to be reviewed and adjusted to the current social economic landscape. Aisha Janif has the story.
Despite record high unemployment rates and an extended lockdown in Melbourne, the Morrison government plans to go ahead with a $300 cut to the historic JobKeeper and JobSeeker subsidy announced in April. This was at the height of the coronavirus. Treasury has stated that the coronavirus supplement is being adjusted in accordance with gradually improving economic conditions. Truby Williams, a professor of economics at Melbourne University, has this to say.
There's a lot of uncertainty about sort of what will happen with the course of the economy because of COVID. Like, you know, we don't know whether we'll be able to keep it suppressed until we get a vaccine. We don't know how much the vaccine will, allow us to kind of resume living as we did before. We don't know whether the vaccine, the extent to which it will allow us to open up international borders. So that's one point. And the other point is that the nature of the problems that you need to deal with change as the recession goes on. So at the moment, for example, we don't have a lot of, we've had a big increase in unemployment, but most of those people are short-term unemployed because, just by definition, they've only just become unemployed, so they're still short-term unemployed. So in the initial stages of the recession, one problem you're not usually dealing with is a lot of people are long-term unemployed. But in 18 months or so, more people are long-term unemployed, and you need policies to sort of address that. So I think all policies, to deal with a downturn like a recession have to be, temporary in some sense, in that you have to be able to respond to the changing nature of the recession. And I think that's particularly true in the COVID recession, because we're also dealing with this extra uncertainty produced by the evolution of the virus.
With the economy diving into its first recession in nearly 30 years, the JobKeeper wage subsidy will continue till March next year, with payments following a tiered system. The JobSeeker wage subsidy, however, will only continue for another 3 months, then revert back to its original rate of $565.70. Associate Professor at the Social Policy Research Centre at the University of New South Wales, Dr. Bruce Bradbury, is concerned about the impacts this will have on the economy and those hit hardest by a depressed job market.
So there's an impact, obviously, on the economy, a situation where inflation is incredibly low, reduction in demand in the economy, even in the sectors which are not being locked down. So the government really needs to spend more, and they need to spend more provide more income to the section of the population who's going to spend that income on goods and services to boost the economy. And it's people at the bottom end of the income distribution who are most likely to spend it. Many higher income people, in fact, at the moment are saving quite heavily because many of the expenditures going out to restaurants, international travel and so on are not possible to make. So tax cuts, for example. There's talk that the government is going to introduce tax cuts, which will mainly benefit the top end of the distribution. They're going to mainly be saved, and they won't actually help boost economic activity. Interestingly, the temporary increase in the supplement, there's been some evidence collected, you know, talking to people in those circumstances, explaining how that has actually had a huge boon for their living standards. They've been able to afford.
Minimum wage since the 1st of July 2020 is just over $750 per week. Even after the governmental subsidies, those on JobKeeper and JobSeeker are still being subject to payments below the minimum wage. The last comprehensive review of the Australian welfare system was conducted over 25 years ago, and the social and economic landscape has changed quite drastically, according to Trubia Williams.
We're coming into a period of time where, unfortunately, we're likely to have increased, elevated number of people, who are out of work or have limited work, who rely to some extent or entirely on job seekers as their source of income. And so the welfare consequences of having, an adequate rate of job seeker, for if you've got 10% of people relying on job seeker, then obviously the rate of job seeker becomes doubly important in thinking about the average standard of living of people in Australia. So to me, the kind of importance of getting job seeker the rate right is that we are likely to be in a period where more people will be unemployed. And so, whatever the rate of job seeker is has broader consequences for sort of average living standards in Australia.
For a few years now, lobby groups, academics and policymakers and the like have been pushing for a review on the welfare payments. The common argument against higher rates and subsidies continues to be that it cannot be afforded by the government and it incentivises people not to work. But Dr. Bradbury says that's incorrect.
The reasons for not increasing it are basically twofold. One is expenditure, the cost. And I think the COVID-19 crisis has shown that the public generally does have a willingness to help people who are particularly disadvantaged. Now, of course, the argument that some in the government have been putting forward against keeping JobSeeker high is that it's going, by having a high rate of JobSeeker, that's going to discourage people from looking for work. Now, in some circumstances, that's a valid argument. But right now, with so many more people unemployed and there are job vacancies, that's not really a relevant argument. If a few people stop looking for work, there's plenty to take their place. And indeed, even as the economy recovers, there's still a lot of scope to increase job seeker above the level that it was earlier this year.
There has been a strong stigma around being on welfare payments for many years, and COVID-19 seems to be changing that.
And it's people have come to realise that everyone is at risk of losing their job under some form of economic crisis. So I think that realisation has tended to broaden support for income payments to the most disadvantaged in society. Well, it's more important because more people are affected now. That's certainly the case.
Associate Professor in Social Policy at the University of New South Wales, Bruce Bradbury, ending that report by Isha Janif. And that's all we have for you on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to our producers Toby Hemmings, Aisha Janif and Tina Quinn this week. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2 SER FM for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2SER.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcast, follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Roderick Chambers. Going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company and do stay well.